Gentlemen, first case for argument, United States versus Demery. Mr. Daisy.
May it please the court, Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. I represented Mrs. Demery before the district court by appointment and continue that representation on appeal. The matter is before the court on direct appeal, challenging a sentence as unreasonable only in respect of the court's choice of sentencing guidelines in considering the sentence. It is our position that the court's choice of a higher guideline enacted after the date Ms. Demery's offense was completed acted in this case to create a significant risk of higher punishment. And in practice, indeed, disadvantaged Mrs. Demery in that the court expressed the view that the sentence was 3 months higher than might have been imposed had the court used the guideline in effect at the date of the offense was committed in considering the sentence. It's our position that the significant disadvantage contemplated by the Supreme Court in Garner versus Jones attaches when the court considers.
Aren't all the previous cases ones where the guidelines were binding? Now they're just advisory.
That's true. I can say that of all the circuit courts of appeals that have considered this issue post Booker, all have presumed that the same rules continue and that imposition or use of a higher guideline enacted.
We haven't really discussed it except our Roche case.
That's correct.
So why should it be the same? It's a different regime now, right?
It is, but the analysis of the United States Supreme Court in Miller versus Florida and in Garner versus Jones and its predecessors, I would argue, should lead the court to the same
why?
Conclusion. First, empirically, the court decisions of this court and other courts of appeals have placed the guidelines in a very significant position, and I would argue the significant position contemplated by the remedial opinion in Booker. That is, that they're to be given great weight. They continue to be terribly important in a post-Booker world.
What if the president appointed a blue-ribbon commission of penological experts, and they issued a report which said sentences are too light and judges should always be giving maximum sentences? Would that be an ex post facto law?
No, sir.
Why not?
Congress had no involvement in that decision. And secondly, it has it wouldn't have...
All right, have it Congress appoint the commission then.
Congress appointed the commission, and Congress approved this policy statement. Judges should always impose maximum sentences.
No, Congress wouldn't. No, it appoints the commission. The commission issues this statement. Is that an ex post facto law?
Just as the Supreme Court looked to the real world in Garner versus Jones
yes
to determine,
no.
I would say if looking at the real world, that
just answer my question, yes or no, then you can explain.
Pick either one; it doesn't make any difference.
No,
attaboy.
Thank you.
Academically, thank you, Your Honor. I had to stutter first, but I did come up with an answer. Academically, the dictum in Roche makes perfect sense. And academically, what the court has posited makes perfect sense.
Apparently it makes sense to the government now, too, doesn't it?
It does.
Does it? I mean, Roche says it's not double jeopardy. Or not double jeopardy.
Not ex post facto.
Ex post facto.
That's what the dictum in Roche says. And of course, Judge Hamilton did everything exactly right.
But the government now joins you, right?
They do. I've waited 29 years to say I couldn't agree more with the position of the Department of Justice on this appeal. They do for different reasons. The Department of Justice has cobbled together a worldview in which the sentencing guidelines are like some massive black hole in space around which other Section 3553A factors must remain in close orbit. And decisions of this court dealing with reasonableness of sentence imposed post-Booker sort of move in that direction. Judges can't get terribly far away from a sentence imposed within the sentencing guidelines without explaining in some detail why such a deviation is reasonable. And the further the district court judge gets away from a sentence within the advisory sentencing guidelines, the more this court demands by way of explanation from the district court. Certainly a presumption of reasonableness on appeal for a sentencing guideline sentence that this and many other circuits have imposed post-Booker mirror, but in a different degree, the Florida statute at issue in Miller. That is, the Florida statute allowed no appellate review of a sentence imposed within the guideline range that the court determined to be appropriate. The court didn't have to explain its choice of sentence. Certainly, post-Booker sentences imposed within the sentencing guidelines remain reviewable for reasonableness. So there's a difference in degree, yet I don't recall this court having declared a sentencing guideline sentence to be unreasonable post-Booker. The court sent back several cases for further findings, but in practice, they remain terribly...
From the purposes of the ex post facto clause?
Well,
what's the purpose of the ex post facto clause?
Fair warning to a person as to
That's
the consequences
kind of their
behavior.
That's kind of absurd to this case, right?
No less.
If this person had known he might have gotten a three-month longer sentence, she wouldn't have committed the crime?
No.
Then what's the point?
That was exactly the state of the law when Sechrist was decided. Criminals don't go out and look at those guidelines before they go jacked up on cocaine and rob a bank.
So what's the purpose of your appeal? I don't understand.
Fundamental fairness.
What's the fairness?
My client
it's not
got.
She was entrapped into committing a crime by thinking the penalty would be 3 months lower, right? So what's the injustice?
It's the same injustice that has always been viewed as a violation.
Always. No, I mean, you can understand how people engage in conduct, and then years later, Congress says, oh, you committed crimes. I mean, that's ex post facto. There's nothing like that here. She knew perfectly well this was criminal conduct, and she had an approximate sense of, you know, she knew she could be punished. Her conduct wasn't affected by the fact that the guidelines were changed so she could get, she might get a 3 month longer sentence, right?
That's true. In reality, that's always been true.
This is unreality, right? First you said we shouldn't be academic, we should be realistic. Now you admit we're in a realm of unreality.
I need to straddle both horses here, if I might.
Right,
no, but the court's exactly accurate. I think it's fair to say that all the decisions of the United States Supreme Court and other circuit courts of appeals that posit that the possibility or imposing a greater punishment after an offense has been committed violates the ex post facto clause. It's always been an issue of constructive knowledge. That is, we as a government have to operate under the assumption that people actually read the law and read these statutes and that they conform their behavior. It's constructive only.
So it's all fiction.
No, it's the constructive.
It's all fiction because obviously Demery didn't read the sentencing guidelines, right, before she decided to commit crimes.
She's very intelligent.
I suppose. But I'd say this. Our entire system of laws fall apart if we presume people don't read them.
Based on fiction?
Pardon me?
You're kidding.
Excuse me, sir.
You're kidding.
No, I wouldn't kid the court.
You think our system depends on assuming that everybody reads the sentencing guidelines?
Knows the law. Ignorance of the law is no excuse, I think.
It is. We are presumed to have, even when we do things.
It's one thing to say ignorance of law is not a defense. Another thing to say that our system rests on the fictitious assumption that everybody knows the law.
The young man that was the first person in America to be prosecuted for having a shotgun when there was a domestic relations order against him as a prohibited person with a gun. Had no way of knowing, practically, and this court so found, had no way of knowing that it was illegal.
Right.
Yet he was convicted, he was sentenced, and off he went. And I would argue the same
thing. He wasn't sentenced because we think everybody knows the law, right?
He was charged with knowledge of that law that nobody knew about.
No.
No. So I can't imagine the purpose of rebuttal under these circumstances, but with the court's leave, I'll...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Olson?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Olson on behalf of the United States. The government agrees that...
I find your position completely baffling, disserving the interests of the Justice Department, and only intelligible on the theory that you're fighting some rearguard action against the Booker case.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree.
Why is it in the interest of the Justice Department to be taking this position?
Well, one, I mean, the interest of the Justice Department is to reaffirm and promote the idea that the Supreme Court suggested in Booker and so many of the courts of appeals have adopted, that even in the post-Booker world where the sentencing guidelines are advisory, they continue to play a central principal role in the sentencing of criminal defendants. This court itself has held that when a district court makes an error in calculating the guideline range, the case must be remanded for resentencing because even under an advisory regime, this court will presume that the district court's judgment about the reasonableness of the sentence will be affected by the advisory range that they calculate to begin with.
Sure, but there's a big difference between making a mistake and using a subsequent guideline, right?
Well, in any event...
If the judge doesn't know what he's doing, he make a mistake, he thinks he's doing one thing and doing something else, sure, you want to correct that. There's no mistake here.
No, but the point... My point was that the choice of the guideline range does affect the ultimate sentence. I mean, there is...
Everything affects it. Who the judge is, who's appointed, right? That affects it.
Well, that's true. I think the difference here is that because the guidelines are legal norms that the district courts are required to consider, right? I mean, 3553A4 says that...
Congress passed a law saying, we advise the president only to appoint tough sentencers as judges. Would that be an ex post facto law?
I can't imagine that it would.
So the answer is no?
The answer is no.
Good. You only had two choices.
The answer is no. In this case...
Why is that?
Because if Congress gives the president advice about what to do, Congress doesn't have the authority to require the executive to consider that advice, right?
There's no requirement here. The guidelines don't require anything of anybody.
Well, 3553A4 requires the judge to take the requires
to
the sentencing court to take the guidelines into account.
About it.
That's not what 3553A sets out all the considerations that the judge has to think about when he sentences, whether or not they're in the guidelines.
Right. Well, one of those provisions, 3553A4, says that the district court shall consider the range established by the Sentencing Commission for the offender's offense category and the offender category. The Supreme Court in Booker said that the guidelines continue to play that role.
What if Congress said, you know, passed a law today that said sentencing judges shall consider the heinousness of the defendant's crime? Would that be an ex post facto law?
I think that because 3553A already requires the judge to take into account the characteristics, the nature of the offense, and the characteristics of the offender, that wouldn't be a new...
All right, suppose Congress says that... sentencing judges should consider how harmful white-collar crimes are.
I think that would be hard to... It would be hard to make an ex post facto case there because you've already got the characteristics of the offense being taken into account. Perhaps an easier hypothetical to think about would be if Congress passed a law saying sentencing courts cannot take into account the defendant's the possibility of rehabilitation. Whereas at the time, and so if you have a defendant who by
no,
all
no,
accounts...
But that's a prohibition. We're just talking about where Congress says you shall consider this or consider that.
Yes.
That's what the guidelines are. Court has to consider the guidelines. He's not bound by them.
But the fact that they have to take them into account, and the fact that in practice what we see, and there's a presumption in the courts which bears out in practice, that when the guideline range...
Congress says that every sentencing judge shall consider the punishment that would be meted out in Canada.
That would probably be to the defendant's benefit in most cases.
Iran, then.
Iran. If the result were, I mean, the question is whether it creates a significant risk of an increased punishment, right? That's Garner versus Jones. And so I think one of the things, and what happened in Garner versus Jones, because it was a discretionary system, the Supreme Court returned it to the Court of Appeals to look at actual practice and see if, in fact, this change was creating a significant risk of an increased punishment. And I think here what you have, because we know...
post mush test.
I don't think so, Your Honor, what the significant risk of an increased punishment? I mean, that's the standard that the court laid out in Garner. And I think that if you look at even this court's own presumption that the district court will be guided by the guidelines range that it chooses, and in fact we see...
No, that's not the presumption. The presumption is a sentence within the guideline range is reasonable. It's not that the district judge has to rebut the presumption.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. In the Chamness case, the court was citing another case and said that an error in a guidelines range requires a remand for resentencing because it is presumed that the district court's judgment about the reasonableness of the sentence will be affected by the guideline range that it's considering.
We don't let the judge make a mistake about the guidelines, but it's not like the old departure system. He doesn't have to say, well, this sentence, the guideline sentence is X, but you know, I'm convinced it has to be Y or Z. He can say, you know, it's X, but I've made my own judgment based on the 3553A factors, and I think it should be a different sentence. That's perfectly appropriate.
He
can treat them as purely advisory.
He can treat them advisory, but what we see in practice is that the guideline range that is chosen affects the sentence, or at least creates a significant risk of affecting the sentence.
Wasn't he adhering to the dicta in the Roach case?
I'm sorry?
The dicta in Roach, which says exactly what you're arguing against today?
Yes, that's what the district court relied on.
So he did that, and he analyzed the other factors, and he made a coherent decision, rational decision, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. use those other guidelines.
Right. Well, actually, what the district court did was he said, relying on the dicta in Roche, which suggests that the ex post facto clause no longer applies, I can use the more recent book rather than the old book. But he calculated the sentence either way. Right. If he had used the old book, he would have departed upward for underrepresentation of criminal history. And he said, in the end, I want to make absolutely clear, if I believed that the ex post facto clause applied here and I was using the old book, the sentence would be 3 months lower.
Suppose he said, I'm really worried about this ex post facto stuff, so I'm going to use the old guidelines. But now when I apply the 3553A factors, I look at the new guideline, just as information, right? Sentencing Commission knows a lot.
Yep.
I use that as information, and I give the extra 3 months. That would be fine, wouldn't it?
I think that it would be.
Yeah, so what are we haggling about? Just some form of words that the judge is supposed to use? He's supposed to say information?
No, I think what the district court said is, to be very clear, I understand that these guidelines are just advice, but I think they're very good advice.
Right, and suppose the guidelines, the later guidelines, he reads them and he says, this is great, this is much more sensible than those old guidelines, so that's what I'm going to follow. right?
Well, he...
There's nothing wrong with that.
I think that the judge may well have had the discretion to do that.
Is there... Right, there's nothing wrong with that. So if you won, all it would mean would be that we'd have to tell the judges, look, when you want to use later guidelines, just make very clear, just say you're using them as information.
That the first thing you have to do is properly calculate the guideline range using the old guideline.
And you take the new guidelines. You say, I like them better, so I'm going to give the higher sentence.
In this,
that's fine.
The judge would have the discretion to do that. In this case, the judge made very clear that he wouldn't have done that.
From this argument.
I think our key point is that the guidelines, because
the guidelines... But you realize that all that will happen here, the defense lawyers or prosecutors... the prosecutor will say, look, judge, the guidelines have been toughened, and they really make sense, these new tough guidelines. And the judge will say, yes, they really make sense. I'm going to use them as information.
Yes. The position of...
For my exercise of discretion. And that's not ex post facto. You just said that.
The position of the government at sentencing will be that... You know, our position, pending this court's decision, of course, is that the ex post facto clause does apply. We argue for the guideline range that was in effect when there's an ex post facto question. If the Sentencing Commission's more recent thinking on the question has increased the range, we may well argue for a sentence at the top of that old guideline range, but we stand by the guidelines. We think that they are of central importance.
If the judge asks you, do you think the new, tougher guidelines are better than the old, weaker guidelines, your prosecutors will say, sure, we like the new ones. Yeah, we do. But remember, judge, you've just got to treat them as information. Don't think that you're giving a sentence based on those guidelines, right? It's all just words.
Well, except that our recommendation would be, if we do feel strongly that these newer guidelines represent better thinking and more up-to-date thinking, our recommendation would be to use that information to set a sentence at the high end of the guideline range.
Above?
Because our position is that the guidelines are the central...
You know the judge has the discretion to go above the guidelines, so why can't you tell him, go above the guidelines, not because the guidelines have been changed, but because these new guidelines reflect a greater insight into the danger of this particular crime. You don't want to tie the prosecutor's hands by forbidding that type of argument.
We actually believe that the guidelines, because that they play this centrally important role in sentencing and that they should continue to play this centrally important role in sentencing, and because of the ex post facto concerns, you know, we do believe that...
But this is what Judge Posner started out with. This is the rear guard action against Booker, right? I mean, that there's no other reason for you to make the argument you are today.
Well, I mean, obviously...
You wanted those guidelines to force the judges to adhere to the guidelines as much as possible.
Not force. Encourage. We do stand by the guidelines. I mean, we do believe it is our position.
You're afraid judges are more likely to go below than above under the new regime. That's your worry.
Well, I think that probably generally plays out as well.
Well, that's your reason for being here, right? You don't want judges going below the guidelines.
We want judges to
be happy if they went above, but you can't have both, and you'd rather have them stuck in the guidelines than exercising a freewheeling discretion up and down.
We do believe it is absolutely clear post-Booker that judges have discretion, freewheeling discretion, unfettered discretion. We are concerned about that, and the courts of appeals have been concerned with that. The farther a judge goes outside the guidelines, the more compelling the justification needs to be, and it's because the guidelines play a unique national role in creating national uniformity in sentencing. It's why the Sentencing Reform Act was created to begin with, and it's a key, important thing to the court.
And the soft-hearted judges have been a problem all along.
I'm sorry?
I said the soft-hearted judges have been a problem all along.
Right.
So.
Right.
I see my red light is on.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Olson. Mr. Daisy, you have anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, well, we thank you and the defenders for your representation. Mr.